Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Naughan, and I'd like to welcome you to a special presentation of the Progressive Commentary Hour. The theme, vaccines. The questions for our panelists, are vaccines safe and effective? If so, what is the proof? Are vaccines not safe or effective, and what is the proof? Do vaccines give us lifetime immunity? Is vaccination the same as immunization? I have assembled a panel. Each will have an opportunity to address these issues in whatever way they choose. I will not interrupt them, as I believe in doing the commentary on the air approach, meaning this is a classroom. Let us all sit, take notes, and understand that these individuals, each of these are women doctors and scientists, has spent years investigating this in depth. They put their reputations on the line because they all offer legitimate challenges. We're going to begin with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. She is a physician who incorporates integrative medicine into her practice for treating allergies and childhood illnesses and women's health issues. She also is a person who has spent a great deal of time looking at the politics around vaccines and the impact of vaccines on public health and their medical risks in children. She is the author of two books, Fowl, Bird Flu, It Is Not What You Think, and Say No to Vaccines, a resource guide for all ages. She will be followed by Dr. Nancy Banks. Dr. Banks is a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist at Harvard Medical School, and she has had 25 years of practice in this field. She also has an MBA and conducts cutting-edge research in the history of medicine. So she is also the author of AIDS, Opium, and Diamonds, and Empire, the Deadly Virus of International Greed. She will be followed by Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, board-certified nephrologist and an internist practicing in Bangor, Maine. And after witnessing several of her patients developing kidney failure following last season's H1N1 and seasonal flu vaccines, she undertook an investigation that alighted her into vaccine serious risks. She now focuses on educating physicians and other public health officials on the truth behind vaccines. The program will conclude with Dr. Merrill Nass, NASS, board-certified physician in internal medicine, practicing at the Mount Desert Island Hospital in Bar Harbor, Maine. And she also runs a clinic treating patients of Gulf War Syndrome, multiple chemical sensitivity, fibromyalgia, and chronic fatigue. She is regarded an expert in biological warfare and bioterrorism, which she has been investigating for over 20 years. And she has testified on four separate occasions under oath before congressional committees. Now, our program. And again, I will not be interrupting our guest, as I want them to have every opportunity to take this discussion wherever they choose, providing that they are addressing the issues of, are vaccines safe? Are they effective? Are they not safe or effective? Lay out your case. Are vaccines the same as immunization? Because we call vaccines immunization. Are they indeed one and the same? What is the problem with natural immunization? What is the problem with all the vaccines? That is our story. Please join us now on the Progressive Commentary Hour. Welcome to our program, Dr. Tenpenny. My questions are simple. I will sit back with the audience and listen to your answers. Are vaccines safe and effective? If so, what proof do you have? Are they not safe or effective? If so, what is the proof? And discuss your experience with vaccines and the what you consider the myths or misinformation around them. The forum is yours.
The whole issue of vaccine safety has been that we've always been told that vaccines are safe, but we've never really explored the other side. Are vaccines unsafe? Vaccine safety studies are short, they're inconclusive, they don't go on for a long period of time. All the studies are performed on children who are not ill, on no medications, and are by definition healthy. But once a vaccine is approved, it's been given to all children and all adults, even those who have been chronically sick and are on many different types of medications. So we really don't know until that happens what the true clinical trial is around safety. When I first started researching vaccination and looking at the whole concept of vaccine efficacy, because what always comes out is that vaccines are safe and effective, it took me a while to figure out what that word effective really even meant. We as clinicians and doctors and even parents and the lay public, when they hear the word effective, they assume that what that means when the phrase is said, vaccines are safe and effective, meaning that vaccines are safe and they will keep you from getting sick. But digging deeper into the scientific research, what I came to find out was that what effective really means is that a substance is injected into a body and it creates an antibody. And if an antibody response is generated by that shot, then the science says the vaccine is effective. It did what it was supposed to do. The shot created an antibody. There is a leap in assumption then that simply because you have the antibody, it will protect you and keep you from getting sick. And there's a lot of information out there that says that antibodies, we're not really sure what they really mean. Do the antibodies really mean that you are chronically sick? Does it mean you've had an exposure? You've had a certain level of protective antibody and you can still get sick? So the whole word in the scientific literature about effective vaccines means that you create an antibody. But that doesn't necessarily translate from effective into protecting you from getting sick. Recently, we have seen outbreaks of mumps and pertussis in the last couple of years. And in the mumps outbreak that happened in Iowa about 2 or 3 years ago, we found that 67% of the children who contracted mumps had at least one, many of them two, MMR vaccines, so they should have been protected from getting the mumps. In the pertussis outbreaks that were happening in California, we found that out that the vast majority of those children had had pertussis vaccination and had the full series. We know that in the military that there are people that have been fully vaccinated, and there have been outbreaks of rubella and measles. So we also know from the medical literature that even people who have been fully vaccinated against tetanus, that have had four or more tetanus shots and have antibodies levels, which would be defined by the medical literature as being protective antibody levels, still contracted full-blown tetanus, which then tells us that having an antibody doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be protected from getting the illness for which you've been vaccinated against. We use the words immunization and vaccination as though they were synonyms. They are not. Vaccination, by definition, is the act of giving a shot. And that is what vaccination really means. Immunization means that you have become immune. You do not necessarily become immune from a vaccine. In fact, there's a large body of evidence that shows that it only causes harm. It really doesn't make you immune at all. So the definition of immunity means that you have had a natural infection from a community-acquired virus or bacterial infection, but primarily viruses. And the difference being is that vaccination engages mainly one part of your immune system, which is called the Th2 side of the immune system, and it primarily engages that arm. That's why over time, when you have an antibody, it goes away. And that's why even those who believe in vaccines know that the antibodies wane and why they are promoting now many, many, many booster shots. We know that when you have a community-acquired infection, such as measles or mumps or rubella or even influenza or chickenpox, it engages both sides of the immune system, the side that's called Th2, which creates the antibodies, the Th1 side of the equation, which engages the self-immunity that is defined by the difference between knowing who you are and where your environment stops. And those two types of the immune system go through this really nice dance when you have a real infection and you have fever and you have cytokines and you have white blood cells and you have all of these different types of portions of your immune system coming together in a dance. And that's where lifetime true immunity comes from. When you are re-exposed to a virus or re-exposed to that infection, your immune system has been fully engaged and recognizes that and says, I don't have to process that again. We've done that once. They push out a little bit of intrinsic immune system help to push that virus out of the way, and that's where true immunity comes from. When babies are born, they are by definition born immature. Their neurological system is immature, their immune system is immature, their lungs have to take that first deep breath in order to get surfactant and mature their lungs. So from the moment of birth and that first deep breath, there are an enormous number of cascades that have to happen in order for all of the systems to be go and to click on all of the buttons. It's like launching the space shuttle off of the pad. All of the systems have to be go. And all of these cytokines and all of these hormones and everything starts processing all at the same time. What we do to these newborns is within minutes of birth, They're exposed to latex. They're exposed to vitamin K shots. A vitamin K shot that is given almost immediately after birth, on the outside chance that a very rare blood disorder might be happening in this baby. It has 9 milligrams of benzyl alcohol, and there have been reports in the pediatric literature, particularly the Canadian pediatric literature, that thinks that it's that vitamin K shot that's given right at birth that leads these children, many of them, down the pathway into jaundice, and they have kernicterus and all these different problems because their liver is not meant to handle that big dose of alcohol as soon as they're born. Within a few more hours after birth, then we give them a hepatitis B vaccine. The first paper that came out about the hepatitis B vaccine and using that vaccine in America was based off of a study that was done in Southeast Asia, where 10% of the population of women in Southeast Asia are endemic to carrying the hepatitis B virus. That 1991 paper, in essence, said, because hepatitis B is endemic in the population in Southeast Asia, and mothers there have high incidence of hepatitis B, we should probably give the hepatitis B vaccine to children in this country. It made no sense to me then. It probably makes no sense now. And so within hours, we have assaulted this brand new being that's just landed on this planet with all these systems meaning to go, and we've hit them with antibiotics in their eyes. Many times they're exposed to antibiotics coming through the birth canal. If mom has a strep B infection, they get a vitamin K shot, they get a hepatitis B vaccine, they get an exposure to latex, and now they're maybe 6 hours old. A mere 8 weeks old, 8 weeks old, 56 days of life on this planet, the baby goes in for its first well baby checkup. And at that time, they may be given up to 6 or 7 different vaccines, a DPT, which is diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, a polio vaccine, another hepatitis B vaccine, a HIB, which is for Haemophilus influenza B, and possibly a Prevnar vaccine, which is 7 strains of strep, maybe even 13 strains of strep, all given at the same time. So it's like giving 20 or 30 vaccine antigens in about 5 or 6 shots. Each of those shots have chemicals, things like aluminum, polysorbate 80, all kinds of toxic chemicals that are causing lots of problems in immune systems. And that's at a mere 2 months of age. That process is repeated at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months. They get another big dose of vaccines at 1 year of age. So that by the time children are 1 year old, they will have had more than 70 different vaccine antigens injected in measurable amounts of chemicals. In fact, the 2 vaccines that have the highest amount of chemicals, in my opinion, are the MMR and the chickenpox vaccine. Both of them have milligram amounts of gelatin. The gelatin then can be injected into the body, cross the blood-brain barrier, and cause inflammation. They have inflamed brains from all these vaccines that have happened through their developmental years of life. Children get multiple doses of vaccines by the time they're 6 months of age. At about 8 months of age is where they start to get chronic ear infections. And the ear infections come, and then they get an antibiotic and another ear infection and another antibiotic. And they have disruption in their intestinal tract. Then by the time they're 1 year of age, they have their birthday party. They go in for their 1 year checkup with their pediatrician, and they get another round of vaccines. And many of them, within hours, days, weeks, or months, digress into autism. The vaccines are never blamed. They always say that it's anything but. And now that we're seeing more vaccine injury in older children, children that are 9, 10, and 11 that are getting the Gardasil vaccine that's supposed to protect them from cervical cancer, these are children who were athletes, they were scholars, they were musicians, and all of a sudden they are having seizure disorders and they are becoming chronically ill. And that doesn't even include the children on the autism spectrum. With they have all of these learning disabilities, sensory integration disorders, speech delays, all of these other obvious signs of neurological and brain dysfunction. The flu is such an interesting illness that we make such a big deal about. You know, over the last few years we had SARS, and then we had bird flu, and now we've had swine flu, and now they are quiet, and it seems to be these little peaks that there's this big pandemic that's coming. We know it's coming. It's anticipated, it's coming, and they plant all these things into being. I don't understand how they get away with it, quite frankly. I believe that it's an FTC violation. There is so much information out there now that says that flu shots don't work. The Cochrane Collaboration, which is a think tank organization out of Rome that does a complete analysis of all available information on an isolated topic. And several times now, they have reviewed the information on flu shots. And their conclusion is that in all three populations, children and babies starting at 6 months of age, which is where we give flu shots now, middle-aged adults that we ostensibly give the flu shots so that they don't miss work, and senior citizens because we don't want them to die if they get the flu, in all three of those populations, a flu shot is no more effective of keeping you from getting sick than just giving you a sugar pill. The data is unequivocal that flu shots don't work. And then there's all of this media propaganda that says that 36,000 people die every single year from the flu, but by their own information that is a lie. And there's about 700 people that die per year from the flu, and most of them are over the age of 80. The data shows unequivocally that vitamin D is the best way to prevent yourself from getting the flu in the winter. The science that shows that vitamin D peaks up in the summer, influenza goes down, and as the vitamin D levels go down in the winter, particularly when you're living in the northern hemispheres, the incidence of influenza goes up. Well, to me, that's because of the change in vitamin D. I believe that influenza is around all year round. It doesn't come and go. It doesn't migrate like birds. So it doesn't come and go. It's here. So what changes is our susceptibility to that influenza virus. From the time of the very first vaccine, the smallpox vaccine, that was first given in this country in 1801, it has always been a faith and a belief system that vaccines work, that vaccines are safe and they keep you from getting sick, and that if we vaccinate everybody at a very high level, it should keep the population safe from getting sick. And that the rights of the individual to get sick and go around and spread disease if they choose not to be vaccinated by any of the vaccines that are now available is wrong. And that the right of the individual needs to be subrogated to the good of the whole. And that has been one of the political debates about vaccination for 200 years. But times have changed since that argument was first instituted. At that time, there was one shot, a smallpox vaccine. Now we've got 16 different vaccines and multiple doses of them. We have the sickest population ever in terms of children and adults who are on long-term chronic diabetes medicine, other types of pharmaceutical drugs. They are already unhealthy before they are injected. The right of the individual needs to be taken into a higher elevation, because that individual person is at a much higher risk of a reaction to the vaccine than they are to having a problem if they get exposed to the illness. It's my opinion that vaccine injury can be anything from a sore arm and swelling to asthma, allergies, eczema, ADD, ADHD, cancer, insulin-dependent diabetes, and autism. Autism is, in my opinion, at the far end of what's happening in terms of brain destruction from these vaccines. But we have the most unhealthy generation of children in the history of mankind. The largest, most powerful industry in the world is the pharmaceutical industry. They have their tentacles everywhere, into lobbying in Washington, D.C., lobbying at the state organizations to get state mandates passed for vaccines on a statewide basis, to get mandates passed into schools. They have fingers into foundations, fingers into major corporations, the media. They are everywhere, protecting their turf in terms of their drug-based pharmaceutical industry. It's really hard to try to find unbiased research these days and to try to get support for any other types of activities that doesn't somehow have the drug companies associated with it. The media has been purchased by the pharmaceutical industry through advertising. One of the number one advertisers that support their shows are drugs. I challenge anybody who sits down and watches the 6 o'clock news to just take a little tally mark and keep track of how many drug company advertisements that you see in a 30 to 60 minute news segment. It's very hard for them to speak out and say something the truth against their advertisers, or they would pull their livelihood. I really believe that if we stopped vaccinating completely, if we just stopped the vaccine industry, and we got everyone's vitamin D level up to 80 nanograms per ml, up to a really significant level, and we did basic, important lifestyle changes, exercise, organic food, plenty of water, and I can't overstress the importance of adequate sleep. If we did those things in one generation, I truly believe that most chronic disease would just go away. we would still have a pharmaceutical industry for important things and acute illnesses. We're still going to have people that are going to have appendicitis or have a kidney stone or fall down and break a bone. We do need to have a medical industry, but we don't need a $500 billion pharmaceutical industry creating more drugs for problems that they've created from birth from all these vaccines.
Thank you very much, Dr. Timpany. I appreciate your input. Back in a moment with our next guest, Dr. Nancy Banks. Welcome to our program, Dr. Banks. As I have with each of our panelists, I'm asking you the same questions. Are vaccines safe and effective? If so, what is the proof? Are they not safe and effective? If so, what is the proof? And give us any particular insights into the whole concept of vaccines that has intrigued you and caused challenge. The forum is yours.
I've looked very carefully at vaccines because my background is as an obstetrician and gynecologist. And one of the things that women certainly are going to be concerned about is whether or not they should give their children vaccines and how safe are the vaccines. And so part of my job was really looking at the safety and efficacy of these vaccines. And unfortunately, what I found that the CDC and the FDA were telling people and the truth of the vaccines were two different things. When I started in medicine, the rate of autism among children in the United States was about 1 in 10,000. And now the rate of autism is 1 in 100. Now, there is no way that could be a genetic problem. So it has to be an environmental problem. So the issue is, what has happened over the last 25 to 30 years to cause this epidemic of autism? And so the only thing that really has changed is the number of vaccines that are giving, that are being recommended and are being given to children. So the issue is, what exactly is in those vaccines? Well, if you look at the ingredients of the vaccines, you will find that they have mercury and they have aluminum, and the vaccines are polluted with other kinds of viruses, and the vaccines are grown sometimes on human tissue. So these are vaccines that have elements that are neurotoxic, and then, of course, they have other elements that can set up autoimmune reactions. And so those are the kinds of things that we are seeing in the children. We are seeing autoimmune reactions. We are seeing an autoimmune reaction against the brain tissue. And so these children, unfortunately, even the ones who are not developing the syndrome of autism, are developing other syndromes such as ADD and ADHD. And, of course, the secondary problem is the number of allergies that we're seeing in our young children. And part of the allergic reaction has to do with the fact that the immune system is not completely developed at birth. It takes about 3 years for the immune system to be developed. And so if you begin to give children vaccines, you actually set their immune system toward one part of the immune system called the humoral part, which makes more antibodies. Yet at the same time, you're suppressing their cellular immunity, which never develops completely. So the idea that we need to give children the number of vaccines that we're giving is simply a false notion. So the question I think that we have to ask ourselves, well, why is this being done? Well, for me, there are several reasons. One, it has to do with the pharmaceutical industry and the profitability of the pharmaceutical industry, because you have a whole population of children who become captive to the pharmaceutical industry. So that's number one. Number two, there was a book written several years ago by Lily Kay called The Molecular Basis of Biology. And Lily Kay was a medical historian out of Yale, very well respected. And she looked at the medical industry and how it was developed and the philosophy that was being pursued through biology. And of course, what she understood was that the entire medical paradigm was developed, the Western allopathic paradigm was developed by people who were essentially believed in eugenics. The other issue with vaccines is this. There really is no firm evidence that vaccines do what they say they do. They say that the introduction of vaccines actually reduced the amount of infectious diseases. But if you go back to the beginning of the century, you will really see that the thing that was reducing infectious diseases was an improvement in diet, an improvement in sanitation, an improvement in education. And so the societal things, the environmental things that were improving as a result of improving economies, and that economies and that people in those economies were doing better economically, you see that the number of infectious diseases were going down. I think that the idea that we can put toxins and poisons into a perfectly healthy immune system, a bloodstream, and not expect to get complications is naive at best, and more so, it's probably quite evil. When you're going to medical school, you actually think that you're studying science, but you're studying the science that someone has decided that is appropriate for you. And the science that they consider not appropriate for you, you don't study. For example, at the beginning of the century, the Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundations took over the discipline of allopathic medicine. How did they do that? They did it through their foundations, and they were able to finance those schools and those people that would actually promote the ideas, the eugenic ideas. So most of the students who come out of medical school are not going to question that. They are simply going to say, this is what I learned, and so this is how I'm going to proceed. It must be true. And they will go to the CDC or the FDA website, and that website will repeat the things that they heard in medical school. And one of the things that I found is that most of these doctors do not go to the original literature. They don't read the literature that would really question whether or not these vaccines are safe. And there's an enormous amount of propaganda, for example, from the pharmaceutical industries. So the pharmaceutical industries have enormous amounts of money to promote their particular products, whereas the people who are promoting health benefits of a more normal or natural type have almost no money. So this is one of the problems. So now you have a group of people who've spent 4 years under these conditions, who come out of medical school, and now they're expected to be the authority, and their patients think that they are the authority, except the authority that they have is the authority that they've been given. It's almost papal in nature. And so that is basically how we get to the point where we are today. For example, you may not be able to do it in a first world country, but say you go to another country in Africa or Southeast Asia. You say, okay, this group of children has not been vaccinated, this group of children is vaccinated. What is going to be the outcome in these two children in terms of developing measles or smallpox or whatever? So that would be how you do it. But these studies have never been done, and I don't think these studies are ever going to be done. And unfortunately, the drug companies have too much invested in the whole vaccine paradigm right now. And the other big problem at this point is there are so many children that have been harmed that to back away from this paradigm at this time would be a disaster financially for these people, because somebody is going to have to account for the number of children who've been damaged. When we study cell biology, we study proteins, carbohydrates, and fats, but 80 to 90% of our body is water, and so we don't even study water. So for me, it was my own illness that really made me begin to look at the entire paradigm of allopathic medicine. And so once I did that, again, because I'm an obstetrician-gynecologist, I started looking at the vaccines that we were recommending, because at that point, many women began to say, I don't think I want to give my children these vaccines because I've heard that the vaccines cause autism. And I wasn't sure about it myself, and so that's when I really began to look at the vaccines and I began to look at the data. Well, the data was really quite alarming to me, and I felt that I needed to be able to give my patients options. I was giving my total commitment to vaccines before, and as I began to look at the data, I had to back away from it. But most doctors, unless you have a crisis in your life or you have a crisis with a patient, I think most doctors really don't examine what they're doing. I think they do what they do because they've been trained. They haven't been educated. And that is the problem with our entire so-called education system. We're not educating people to think. We're training people to do a job. Well, one of the things that I've come to realize is that we're not doing science. We're doing warfare. And warfare works on many levels. People tend to think of warfare as guns and cannons, but warfare starts out on a psychological level. And so what happens to people who step outside of the medical paradigm and start to really want to do healing? It can be quite dangerous. If you're an academician and you have status in the university, you can lose your funding. You can lose your graduate students. If you're a clinician in the community, you can have the medical society come after you. If you have a position on a university hospital or a staff, you can sometimes lose your position on the staff because the other physicians are there to make sure that you practice what they call the standard of care. So the standard of care may not have anything to do with the best care or what is scientifically valid. It has to do with what everybody else is doing. And what is so interesting about this is that I was reading about the Inquisition. Now, the Inquisition was a period in European history that lasted for about 300 years. And one of the fascinating things for me is that at least 9 million people were killed during this time for going against the teachings of the church. And most of those people who were killed were women. Many of them were midwives and herbalists because the church believed that if you were sick, it was a sin and therefore you needed to suffer. And of course, these women were about reducing suffering and healing people and making people feel better. And so there were 300 years of persecution of women who were healers. And today we certainly don't have an Inquisition in terms of the church, but we still have an idea that medicine can only be done in one way. And if we don't do it that way, then we have the Inquisition. We have the Inquisition of the pharmaceutical industry. We have the Inquisition of the AMA. We have the Inquisition of the local medical societies who actually will come after physicians and try to destroy their practices or their careers. I think people need to know that vaccines are dangerous, that the idea that there's no risk to a vaccine, there's no risk currently or in the future is an idiotic notion. I think we have enough data at this point to know that vaccines can cause damage immediately or in the future, and that we need to be able to give our parents enough information to make informed choices. And I think that we need to actually stop with the vaccines at this point. Recently, the Merck and one other pharmaceutical company have been promoting a vaccine against cervical cancer. First of all, there's no proof that HPV causes cervical cancer. Association is not causation. There's no proof that this vaccine works. The vaccine was only tested for 4 years before they put it on the market. Of course, cervical cancer does not show up in women until they're in their 40s, 50s, or 60s. So how is it you're going to give a 13-year-old, a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old girl this vaccine and think that it's going to prevent something that happens to her 50 years later? And we've had a number of deaths with this vaccine. We've had some children who are developing long-term medical conditions, which we have no idea whether they're going to reverse. And so we're giving a vaccine which is totally useless, which has no proof that it has any efficacy, and has solid proof that it is harmful, and yet people are sacrificing their young daughters to the vaccine gods. I find that, right now I'm living in Mexico, and in Mexico, they say the Aztecs used to sacrifice people to the gods. And so I think here in North America, we are sacrificing our children to the vaccine gods, and I'd like to see a change because I think it's quite primitive.
Thank you, Dr. Banks. Back in a moment with our next guest, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Welcome to our program, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. As I've asked the other panelists, are vaccines safe and effective? If so, what is the proof? Are they not safe and effective? If so, what is the proof? Are vaccines the same as immunization? And what other aspects of vaccine research and application are you concerned with? The forum is yours.
I have been studying vaccines for the past 3 years of my life when it came up in my professional life. And my current opinion about vaccinations is that they have never been safe. Never has there been a safe vaccine. Never will there be a safe vaccine. And it is not possible to have a safe vaccine. The reasoning for that is that the actual process of vaccination defies the natural function of the immune system of living beings. It thwarts the immune system into a balance that's very unnatural and that leaves it susceptible to more things than just what you've maybe vaccinated supposedly for. Putting a disease matter into a body and thinking that the manner of which it's going in, i.e. usually through a muscle, through the skin, using a very unnatural thing, a needle, combined with all the chemicals and antibiotics and things that the manufacturing companies may not even know about at the time that they're being injected into a muscle, there's no possible way that that can be safe. Now, when you're bypassing the normal immune system by putting this disease matter into a muscle, you are stimulating yet another abnormal response at the site of the injection, pooling of all sorts of metals and things that call in the immune cells in this very unnatural way. And the result that these manufacturers or designers of vaccines often look for is simply an antibody, which is one small thing in the cascade of immunity that is so incredibly elegant they probably cannot appreciate, obviously don't appreciate, if calling a simple antibody, which is highly unpredictable, immunity is insanity. If indeed it is such a miraculous product, wouldn't we be noticing how miraculous it is? Are they saying that we are just too stupid to notice that this is killing people and maiming people, that we're too stupid to notice that it's miraculous? You know, I think that is a lot of the argument. We're just too stupid to notice how miraculous this is. So to protect everybody, they're going to give it to us anyway. Why must such a wonderful product be forced upon people since the beginning of vaccination? If people were really seeing each other dropping dead of smallpox and they were really seeing each other being saved by a smallpox vaccine, the line would be out of town, you know, to get it. That's never been the case. The history books really show that the people that were vaccinated were among the sickest, that many children were dying after smallpox vaccinations, that they were developing terrible ulcerations. Beautiful, perfect babies, you know, forced into smallpox vaccines, either dying or developing terrible, terrible diseases. And the diseases are often said, oh, that would have happened anyway. But parents who watch this happen time and again know otherwise. So those of us who actually notice the science is not backing up vaccination, those of us who notice that people are being maimed and killed by vaccinations, those of us who have experienced our own vaccine reactions are categorically thought to be mad, despite the fact that we've actually studied it. You know, none of my colleagues in the past studied vaccines, yet they still would think that the sound bites that they heard over and over and over the years about vaccines being safe and effective trumped any book knowledge that I may have attained and tried to discuss with them. It's baffling. It's like the minds have been sucked into this paradigm so deeply, and it's not just the minds of these doctors, but it's the safety net, and it's the comfort zone, and it's the rewards that they're getting as a result of all they're doing. And the rewards are not watching people get healthy. The rewards are monetary and the rewards are power. That's it. It's money and it's power. Many of the vaccine enthusiast doctors will parrot the phrase that babies need to be vaccinated when they're young because the take rate is better for the vaccine. Parents are being told to bring their 2-month, 4-month, 6-month-old infants in to have them injected with some 24 different disease matter injections, complete with the polysorbate 80, amounts of aluminum that are absolutely unsafe with the amount of body weight they're being injected into, which, by the way, is to generate the immune response that's desired. That's what the aluminum is there for. They're being told to bring these children in, and the real reason is because they need to get them there at 1 year. They need to train the parents. So to train the parents, they're injecting these children. I mean, how sick is this? If it's only to train the parents, then why not just give them a saline injection at 2, 4, and 6 months, and let's just keep it to ourselves? Why do we have to inject disease matter that won't be effective and that will be problematic at 2, 4, and 6 months? An infant's immune system develops slowly. That's normal. It's part of the design. There are certain interleukins and TNFs, which are other kinds of immune cell secreted chemicals that fire up our immune system, that are specifically by nature blunted in a newborn. Vaccine scientists have been working on developing a way to rev those chemicals up, because they think nature is flawed, because they think Mother Nature got it all wrong when designing the immune system of an infant, that Mother Nature had no idea how to create a human being that could fight off its own diseases while it was an infant and as it was growing. These immune chemicals that are not secreted at high levels for an infant are done so purposefully so that the immune system can develop slowly and, I'll say, thoughtfully, because the immune system does have a mind of its own. So it has to be able to respond correctly, react correctly, give feedback correctly. It is essentially like a mind in that sense. So why aren't these children all dying? Why are they not extremely vulnerable to disease, more so than the vaccine enthusiasts actually say they are, is because of breast milk. It's because of breast milk from a healthy mother who's eating a good diet. This is the design. You know, the design is to have these chemicals at a low level in an immature infant being supplemented by mother's milk. That's it. It's worked for a really long time. It works very well. And what that produces is an immune system that is highly competent in later years. And it puts forward an immune system that is still competent, even in a world full of bacteria, encapsulated bacteria that would require these responses in us, because the mother is able to essentially protect the baby with antibody through breast milk. So the inventors of vaccines have chosen a belief system whereby infants are all born with inadequate immune systems, and that the only way they can be saved from hepatitis B, rotavirus, et cetera, the infant vaccines, that the only way they can be saved from these diseases is getting vaccines into them as quickly as possible in multiple injections. So why do we need multiple injections? Well, they need multiple injections basically because these vaccines don't cause the immune response after one injection that would ultimately be desired by vaccine designers, or maybe not, because each vaccine actually has its own charge that goes with it, the amount of money that it's worth and that is charged for the administration. So the more vaccines given, the more money generated. But also the fact of the matter is that these young babies have a blunted immune response compared to you or I. And that's one of the reasons why the aluminum is added to the vaccines, is to stimulate that immune response by pooling aluminum into the muscle and calling forth immune cells to react to it, which is an absolutely unnatural thing. So what happens when babies are given a vaccine is that this normal non-reactivity of the immune system is abolished. And the non-reactivity then becomes hyper-reactivity, and that's why we're seeing so much asthma, so much reactive airway disease, allergies to peanuts and so on and so forth, latex. It's because of these injections that these young children are getting, not only that have the disease matter in them, but that have provoked the immune system in an unnatural way, shifting the normal balance of non-reactivity into one of hyper-reactivity. I think the reason that many people don't trust their own immune systems is because they've been conditioned to not trust it. They've never been given the opportunity to actually get sick and recover without an allopathic intervention. And because when they do get sick, they're given acetaminophen, ibuprofen, antibiotics, antivirals. And guess what? When you put those things into somebody who's sick, you'll make them sicker. But the person that's sick may think that the illness that they had just got worse. They're not going to think that the drugs that they took, I can't convince people that the drugs that they've taken made them sicker and that they wouldn't have just gotten sicker anyway. It's very difficult because of the belief systems people have in what's on the shelves in the stores and what's being advertised on television, helping them with the beautiful pictures and the healthy people that are used in these ads. And then you have a doctor standing there with a degree who's gone through all this training and education saying, your own immune system isn't enough to fight this. That's because the doctor doesn't know how to take care of an immune system, because the doctor was never taught in medical school how to take care of an immune system. So what you end up with is a whole society from start to finish that doesn't know how an immune system works, that doesn't know how to take care of it, doesn't know how to replenish the nutrients and minerals that are needed, does not know how to ingest a diet that will support it, and then when it fails, it's God's fault. We need a vaccine. You know, it just wasn't designed properly. Or, you know, these infections have gotten so much worse that our immune systems just can't fight them. I don't believe that's true. I don't believe that a healthy system that's detoxified and has a tuned immune system can't handle just about anything that comes along.
Thank you, Dr. Humphreys. Back in a moment with our final panelist, Dr. Merrill Nass. Dr. Merrill Nass, thank you for being with us. Are vaccines safe and effective? If so, what proof do you have? Are they not safe or effective? And if so, what proof do you have? Are vaccines the same as immunization? And specifically, what have you seen in your own scientific and clinical experience that caused you to challenge the safety and efficacy of vaccines as individual entities or in combination? The forum is yours.
Julie Gerberding was the head of the CDC under Bush. And CDC promoted Gardasil vaccine. Gardasil's made by Merck. After she left CDC, when the Obama administration came in, she was required to wait 12 months before going to work for an industry that she had regulated as the head of CDC. And she waited exactly 12 months and then became the president of Merck Vaccines, where again her role was to market Gardasil vaccine. And Gardasil was advertised on the opening page of the CDC website, even after Gerberding had left CDC. So one doesn't really understand how these things work, but certainly industry has a huge influence on federal agencies and uses federal employees once they leave their regulatory role to influence other federal regulators. CDC even has an organization called the CDC Foundation, which is designed to get money from manufacturers to support CDC. I mean, it's rather amazing. But if you go online, you'll find there is a CDC Foundation. They get a lot of money from drug manufacturers. So who is their client? Is their client the American public and the safety of drugs and vaccines, or is it the manufacturer? Children don't usually die suddenly when they're healthy, and you have to find a reason for that. And there are certainly lots of teenage girls who have died relatively suddenly after Gardasil or developed severe neurologic reactions. And therefore, I mean, if you're going to try to balance safety and efficacy, when you prescribe something like a vaccine, you have to know how effective it's going to be. Does this really prevent cervical cancer in young women? And does it prevent it in women who have already been exposed to these viruses? And what happens after a girl gets a number of doses of this vaccine? What is the risk then of an adverse effect? Is it because each time you get another dose, you boost the number of memory cells and antibodies significantly, so that it's very likely that you could go three or four doses, well, you get three initially for Gardasil, and then if it lasts, say, 5 years, which is what some people have suggested, you're getting a booster every 5 years, you may have a serious adverse reaction 5, 10, 15 years down the road from a booster. So if you, you know, I don't know how other doctors prescribe something like Gardasil when it's impossible to figure out what the risk-benefit equation is. Basically, they make an assumption that since the FDA has licensed it and that the manufacturer would not be taking a risk, that the manufacturer could be sued if there were a big problem, that the manufacturer would only market something that's safe, doctors go ahead and prescribe. And what they may not be aware of is that it's extremely hard to link a side effect to a vaccine for many reasons. And so getting a judgment against the manufacturer is very difficult, and it's become more difficult due to some recent litigation that reduced manufacturer liability for vaccines in general. So a paper was published written by an FDA employee that indicated a particular mathematical method was used to analyze adverse event data, and it would tell whether combinations of adverse events occurred together more frequently than would be expected for other vaccines or in general. When I asked her what the method was, well, it turned out to be proprietary. So whatever algorithm was used was developed by a company that was a contractor for FDA, and the company owned the algorithm. So here's this woman who's an MD, and she did not know how the data were being reviewed to make determinations about whether groups of adverse events were occurring together more often than expected. She had no idea what the algorithm was. She did not know whether the method had been validated. She did not know what the value of her conclusions was. You know, she had no idea how the research had been done, and yet she published a paper with these data in it. She also published in this paper said that anthrax vaccine was pretty safe. She minimized the number of adverse events that had been reported of certain kinds, and I challenged her on it, and she did not want to grapple with my challenges, but she had actually made assertions about how many adverse event reports had reported certain adverse reactions, and it so happened that I had a copy of all the adverse event reports for anthrax vaccine, and I had done the analysis with a reporter years ago, and I have updated that analysis subsequently. So I was able to challenge her and say, look, there are many times the number of adverse events that you've reported in your paper that have been submitted to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, to FDA. And so twice you had to go back and say each time, oh, I made a mistake. And then again, I made a mistake. And finally I said, look, you know, this could be considered scientific misconduct. Here you've published a paper and it's full of mistakes. Then her boss called me, and subsequently they published an erratum. They admitted in the journal where her paper was published that they had made these errors and corrected them. They still didn't explain how they got the data, what the algorithm was, and whether it was a valid way of analyzing data for multiple adverse reactions. But I guess one of the points I'm trying to make is that FDA should have its own algorithm for finding out whether multiple adverse events occur together at a higher frequency than expected. And FDA should be doing that analysis for every single drug and vaccine that are being licensed or that have already been licensed. I mean, the VAERS data are post-marketing reports of adverse events. And so that means all the information sent to VAERS is for vaccines that have already been licensed. And FDA needs to be studying them to find out what the adverse reactions are, because when a drug is licensed, it's usually been studied in from 1,000 to 10,000 people. And that's, everybody acknowledges, that's far too few to understand what the rare but potentially very serious adverse reactions are. There are certain times you can't sue a manufacturer virtually at all. There's an extremely strict standard for vaccines that the Secretary of HHS has designated as pandemic vaccines or emergency vaccines. Now, anthrax vaccines, smallpox vaccines, and for a year, the swine flu vaccine, they all got this designation. And so you cannot sue the manufacturer for an adverse reaction from those vaccines unless you've got permission from the Secretary of DHHS and you can show that there was clear negligence, that the manufacturer basically knew there was an adverse reaction and sold the vaccine anyway. And unless you can meet that very high bar, I mean, it's a higher standard than is required for any drug-related problems, you cannot sue. All you can do is apply to DHHS and try to collect money from them for an adverse reaction. And money's been allocated by Congress to a fund for that purpose. But DHHS has not developed standards by which you could go and collect. So in other words, let's say you developed Gulf War syndrome after getting anthrax vaccine. And this avenue is open to military service members, which is interesting, because usually they're not allowed to sue the government. But they can apply to DHHS for a payment. But DHHS is the entity that determines what the side effects are from anthrax vaccine. And DHHS employees are the ones who do the review. There's no money designated to pay a lawyer. So if you hire a lawyer, you pay that person out of pocket. And if you don't like the decision that the DHHS employee made regarding your claim that you had a vaccine injury, it gets reviewed by another DHHS employee. And if you don't like that, you are barred from entering the court system. There is no way you can litigate your claim. So that's for emergency vaccines. So you're absolutely, pretty much absolutely barred from bringing a lawsuit. And if you do collect, the amount you get is, the maximal amount is about $300,000, which seems like a pretty large sum. But if you have a person who's been permanently disabled with a serious neurologic condition, in a child, autism, for example, or in an adult, you know, a brain injury, the cost of care for that person could reach $75,000 or $100,000 a year or more, and so the $300,000 doesn't go very far. The problem is that vaccines can exert their effects positively and negatively for a very long time. So, for example, if you get a live virus vaccine, one hopes that you will be protected throughout your life. So for a smallpox vaccine, it was shown that people had reasonable protection even 50 years after they were vaccinated. Well, obviously, if the immune system is still revved up to protect you against smallpox 50 years later, there's also the chance that that revved up immune system may be causing more autoimmune conditions than it would have otherwise. All vaccines are designed to stimulate the immune system. With killed vaccines, many include aluminum, which is used in the vaccine for several purposes, and one is to provide a depot effect so that the aluminum may bind to the antigen in the vaccine, which has the immune epitope, or the area of the molecule or the area in the virus or the bacteria that you want to develop antibodies against. And the aluminum will slowly release this antigen over many months. So you have a very prolonged effect at continual stimulation of the immune system. And it's possible that that you will still get immune stimulation years later, even from a killed vaccine. So you would think that adverse reactions may develop many months or even years later. But vaccine trials usually last 30 to 60 days. With Gardasil, some of the trials that the manufacturer required did go out to 6 months. And by requiring the manufacturer to conduct a pregnancy registry for several years, and some of the trials did go out for years, they were going to collect data for a longer period. But most vaccines that are now on the market that have been licensed for a long time had very minimal data collection for safety. So that the original data collection for anthrax vaccine from what's called the Brockman trial, which is the trial that FDA has said is the main trial they used for safety and efficacy, they looked at safety issues for 48 hours in that trial. That's it. Everybody got their arm examined at 24 and 48 hours. And it wasn't even believed that vaccines could cause long-term adverse reactions. So there isn't a good data set that one can examine now to find out whether anthrax vaccine causes long-term side effects. FDA doesn't have access to such a data set. The military has its own data. So it has a collection of hospital visits and outpatient visits for all military service members and the diagnoses that were given for those visits, and it has a list of all the vaccinations. The military doesn't share that database. That database was created by Congress after the fiasco of Gulf War Syndrome, when it was very difficult to say what vaccines people received and what illnesses they then got. And so Congress gave the military money and said, you've got to create this database, which is called the Defense Medical Surveillance System. And the military promised that they would make these data available for analysis, but they have not.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nass. And I'd like to thank all of our panelists for giving us a classroom on the air, an insider's view of the truth behind, from their perspective, the safety and efficacy of vaccines. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you for listening.